is the sound you never want to hear. It is the sound of the warning siren going off at a nuclear power plant. When you hear that sound, it means you are in the nuclear hot seat. Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly podcast keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host of this podcast, and I do this because I was 1 mile from the nuclear reactor at Three Mile Island when that accident happened, and it has given me great motivation to keep doing this work. Today we have a very special interview planned with Sean Burney, an independent nuclear consultant to both Friends of Earth U.S. and Greenpeace Germany. With decades of experience on this issue, he brings a unique and international perspective to the strategies, actions, and even the science of the nuclear issue, and we will speak with him in just a short while. Today is Tuesday, March 1st, 2012, 1 year and 51 days since the Fukushima tragedy began on March 11th of 2011. Now, first I want to start with a correction to last week's podcast. I had it written correctly, but I mistakenly read that TEPCO was planning to dump radioactive groundwater into the ocean at a rate of 1,000 gallons a day. The correct figure is 1,000 tons of water per day, which equals over 240,000 gallons per day, or close to a million gallons every 4 days. I never want to understate exactly what's happening with TEPCO. Having taken care of that, here is the latest nuclear news. This last week marked the 26th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster. As expected, there was almost no coverage of the story in the U.S. mainstream media, and what coverage did take place was almost exclusively in Eastern Europe or the alternative press, which is where we went for these stories. On the 26th anniversary of the accident, last Thursday, work began on a giant arched structure to protect the ruined Chernobyl Unit No. 4. The first sarcophagus, which was hastily put around the ruined nuclear reactor, has lasted less than 25 years, and the current one is estimated to cost over $1 billion. The hastily constructed sarcophagus has shielded the remains of the reactor from weather since the weeks after the accident, but the stability of the structure has developed a major risk factor, and its potential collapse threatens to set free more radioactive materials. The environmental restoration work at Chernobyl is funded by 29 donor countries to the Chernobyl Shelter Fund, which was set up in 1997, which raises the question why no comparable consortium has been put together for Fukushima. Meanwhile, according to a report on Euronews, because of the construction work at Chernobyl, they've dug down to the level where the nuclear fuel and graphite lay. This is according to construction expert Yuri Andreev, who is in Ukraine. As a result, the level of radioactivity in the air has risen and exceeds the sanitary norm by hundreds, perhaps thousands of times. Further, according to Euronews reporter Angelina Karakina, the experts believe the encasement doesn't solve the main Chernobyl problem, that of the nuclear waste inside the demolished reactor. But there is currently no chance of moving it to a safer storage facility. Nuclear radiation, the gift that keeps on giving. In India, the indefinite hunger strike has been restarted to protest the Kudankulam nuclear reactors. 25 activists in India have already resumed their indefinite fast against the commissioning of the Kudankulam nuclear power project, and 500 women have pledged to join them as of this Friday, May 4th. The current fast started today, May 1st. The People's Movement Against Nuclear Energy, or PMAIN, has listed 6 major demands, including setting up of a national committee of experts to study the region around Kudankulam's nuclear reactor. The primary demand was that the government institute independent and transparent National Committee on the Hydrology, Geology, Oceanography, and Seismology of the region, according to PMAIN leader M. Pushparayan. Other demands include the conducting of disaster management and evacuation exercises in areas within 30 kilometers of the nuclear plant, and the release of all anti-nuclear peace activists from prison, having them unconditionally taken out of prison with all false charges against them dropped. PMAIN coordinator SP Udaya Kumar and his supporters had previously fasted up to 9 days when on March 28th, a delegation led by the government agreed to look into their demands. They launched the indefinite fast after a state cabinet meeting on March 19, gave its go-ahead for the commissioning of the first 2 reactors. Now that the commissioning looks like it's going forward, the fast, possibly to the death, has resumed. Here in California, we are without nuclear power as of Thursday, April 26th, the Chernobyl anniversary. This is because a swarm of jelly-like creatures forced the shutdown of the Diablo Canyon plant in San Luis Obispo County. Plant operator Pacific Gas and Electra took its Unit 2 reactor offline in the morning in response to a days-long invasion of SELP, which are translucent, spineless, plankton-eating organisms. The intake pipes for seawater became clogged with the creatures, threatening the plant's cooling system. This decision leaves California, at least briefly, without any nuclear power generation, and there have been no rolling blackouts or any other signs of disruption of the energy flow here in California. The second reactor at Diablo Canyon was taken offline earlier this week for routine fueling and maintenance. Pacific Gas and Electra has said that Diablo Canyon will remain offline until the SALP migrate elsewhere. So, in essence, the SALP have created their own movement of Occupy Diablo Canyon. In Japan, physicians have been demanding answers to their research, which has shown that 90% of urine samples have been contaminated with cesium in a city 200 kilometers from Fukushima. Iwate Prefecture conducted a sample survey of radioactive substances in urine in Ichinoseki City and Oshu City. The results, which were published on March 2nd, showed cesium was measured in 119 of the 132 people tested, which is 90% of those people. On April 16, the chairman of Iwate Association of Obstetricians and Gynecologists sent public questions to the Iwate governor, Tasso. Among them were, is there any schedule to conduct research about the diet of the children who they measured cesium from the urine of and about their symptoms? If not, we demand to know the reason. The physicians will also continue to conduct the children's urine tests and health inspection from now on instead of trusting that the city will or the country will take care of it. They are asking for disclosure of the contents of their answers to the media once they receive them and have asked to receive them by May 16th. Additionally, there was an anonymous interview that was placed on ENE News, a video interview with a young woman who didn't want to be identified, but she is a 32-year-old PhD student living in Tokyo, and among her comments she said, I have friends who are medical doctors working in Fukushima, and they get to see people bleeding, losing hair, having bad health condition, and a lot of people are dying. We're going to be talking about the situation in Japan now with today's guest, and I'm very honored to have him here. Sean Burney is an independent nuclear consultant to Friends of Earth U.S. and to Greenpeace Germany. He was formerly campaigner and coordinator of international nuclear campaigns with Greenpeace International for nearly 2 decades. He specialized on nuclear policy in East Asia, nuclear fuel cycle issues, and nuclear power plant safety, and has worked in Japan over a period of 20 years. He led investigations into Tokyo Electric Power Company during the 1990s and the early 2000s, including court hearings in Fukushima City against the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. Sean, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, and I'm pleased to be here.
What you discovered back more than a decade ago, did that lead you to suspect or even expect that a catastrophic accident such as the one that happened could take place?
Well, all nuclear power carries enormous risks, and the Tokyo Electric situation was no different back then. Citizens groups, academic experts, independent engineers, and whistleblowers for decades had challenged Tokyo Electric and the central government over key safety aspects of their nuclear power plants. In the late 1990s, Tokyo Electric had plans to start a plutonium use program where they would take plutonium from reprocessing and put it into MOX fuel, the mixed oxide of uranium and plutonium, and load that into reactor number 3 at the Fukushima Daiichi site. As part of that investigation, and there was an enormous campaign led by citizens groups in Fukushima, it was very clear that Tokyo Electric's safety standards were perhaps the same as everywhere else, but there was certain information that showed that Tokyo Electric were not up to standard, and that they disregarded key safety aspects of nuclear power, including the use of plutonium fuel.
So what has been the impact of Fukushima and the accident on Japan?
Basically, as of this Sunday, the May 6th, there will be no operating nuclear reactors in Japan. Since the Fukushima accident, reactors have shut down for inspection and maintenance, but they also now have to comply with what's called a stress test. We can talk about that in a minute. But basically, every single nuclear reactor, and there were 54 operating nuclear reactors as of March 11th, every single one of those, apart from one, that's the Tomari 3 reactor in Hokkaido, that's the North Island of Japan, all of those reactors have been shut down, and the last one will be shut down this Saturday. So it's the first time in nearly 50 years, 1966 was the first time Japan generated electricity from nuclear. Nearly 50 years of operating with nuclear power. This weekend, it will be operating with no nuclear power. So just on a symbolic level, Japan is demonstrating that as a society, it doesn't need nuclear power.
What is the likelihood that Japan will stay nuclear-free now that all of their reactors will at least be shut down as of this Saturday?
Well, in the last months, there's been a campaign led by Kansai Electric, one of the big utilities, the second largest after Tokyo Electric, and the central government to try and get a number of reactors back up and operational. At the moment, the battle is centered in western Japan, in Fukui Prefecture, the prefecture with the most nuclear reactors in the whole of Japan. And the aim there is to get one and two reactors at Ui operational this summer. There's a huge battle to start them. This is a very powerful industry. It's central to government policy in Japan. At the same time, the resistance, led by largely women and grandmothers, mothers, and activist communities, are fighting back, saying that there's no reason to operate these reactors, that the stress tests that they have to go through are not in any way or near adequate. I mean, in fact, if the stress test was applied to the Fukushima reactors that melted down last year, they would pass this current stress test. So in that sense, they provide no assurance that reactor operations in Japan can be done safely with risks of more earthquakes, tsunamis. There's a huge battle going on. Unfortunately, it's not been so widely reported. My own feeling, unfortunately, is that the industry and government will at some point manage to start a small number of reactors this year, perhaps before the summer. And then the question is, what will be the long-term program in Japan?
What has happened to energy levels in Japan? Are they having rolling blackouts, or have the measures that they took with conservation and other cutbacks been able to take up the slack and allow them to operate much like normal?
Since the reactor program started shutting down after March the 11th, there have been no blackouts in Japan.
There have been no blackouts in Japan.
No blackouts since the March 11th accident. I mean, on March 11th, about 29-30% of Japan's electricity was provided by nuclear. That's an enormous amount of electrical generating capacity. You wouldn't think a society would find it very easy to replace that within a matter of months. One of the consequences has been, and you can imagine this within Japan, Japanese citizens, the public, have embraced the idea that they have to cut back. That's both forced on them and voluntarily. So the measures to reduce energy have been pretty successful. That's not a long-term basis for moving forward. They need to institute much more ambitious programs on energy efficiency, including the design of products and the way systems are operated. In addition, imports of liquid gas and oil have increased. That's not good from a climate and carbon perspective. But it's very clear from independent studies, ones both done in Japan and with institutes, for example, in Germany, that Japan can keep all of its reactors shut down as of May 6th, that through efficiency and the rolling out of renewables, and we can talk about the scale of what's happening with renewable energy in Japan, by 2020 they can be completely off nukes as of now, but also meeting carbon reduction targets that they're required to under Kyoto. That's a much more pleasant prospect for Japanese society, Japanese public health, than relying on nuclear power.
So what I'm hearing you say is that Japan can survive without nuclear power at all.
Absolutely. The utilities may not survive. Currently, in the current form, particularly Tokyo Electric, with the massive debts, I mean, we're talking tens, hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of cleanup costs. The government will probably pass them on to the citizen through taxes. But yeah, Japan can and must continue to operate without nuclear power.
Operating without nuclear power is one thing, because that's the ongoing operation of the facilities. But in the current situation, there's spent fuel storage, there's reactor 4 at Fukushima, and of course the other plants too run the risk from the seismic dangers that are always there in Japan. What is the current situation of the spent fuel storage in reactor 4 and elsewhere in Japan?
Well, as your listeners will remember, three reactors had fuel inside the core. Those cores melted down over a matter of hours and a few days after March the 11th. With Unit 4, that reactor had been shut down at the end of 2010, and the entire fuel core, which was around 100 tons, had been removed from that reactor and placed in the cooling ponds, which are the pools inside these General Electric reactors that are between the second and fifth floor of the building. When the accident happened, they lost cooling capacity, not just for the cores, but also for the spent fuel pools. Each reactor has a pool storing fuel that's come out of those reactors over previous years. The difference with 4 is it had an entire core of very hot fuel that had just been removed from the reactor. That's a much higher heat generation, a much higher radiological content. So Unit 4 has been of particular concern almost from day one because of that high radiological burden within the pool. There are structural issues. Tokyo Electric identified that the risk of collapse of the entire pool building was real, so they instituted a series of structural supports, which was begun in the autumn of last year. They are not that confident that can basically survive a more serious seismic event. But it's important to understand, since March 11th, they've had at least 20,000 seismic events hitting the Japan mainland. Fortunately, none of the level 9 that took place on March the 11th. The problem is the spent fuel in that Unit 4 is effectively ready to be dispersed into the environment. There's no roof over the building at the moment. The water level for the moment remains above the fuel, but if that water level was to drop for whatever reason, the collapse of the building, damage to the actual pool itself, you see very quickly the fuel would start to oxidize, and that's the temperature would rise because of the heat within the fuel. The water between the fuel assemblies would basically start boiling, and then you get a reaction between that and the actual what's called the cladding around the fuel. The fuel wouldn't actually melt. The cladding itself would oxidize. And at that point, you get releases of very large amounts of radioactivity, principally cesium-137, but also the other materials. The worst case would be a total collapse of the pool, which would then scatter the 250-odd tons of spent fuel onto the surrounding ground. The opportunities then to manage that become an absolute nightmare. I don't think anyone has got a plan as to how you deal with fuel that's been scattered over an area around the reactor that's already extremely difficult to operate in because of the background levels are so high already.
And what is keeping the water level to the level that it needs to be right now? Are they continuously adding water to the top of the fuel pool to keep the water level up?
They've been pumping water into the reactors and into the pools since probably around end of March last year. I've not read that there's a serious leak of water from that pool at the moment, so it sounds as if it's structurally holding the water, but the opportunity for maintaining that in the event, for example, of a seismic event or further loss of power where they can't pump the water in, that is ever present. The plan is to build a new structure. You mentioned earlier the sarcophagus at Chernobyl. A less ambitious and certainly less costly option is now being planned, where a structure will be put over Unit 4, which they would argue would prevent the release of radioactivity in the event of a further accident. I doubt that very much. That structure will be built over the next year or more. And then the question is, at what point are they going to be able to remove not just the fuel from that pool, but also from reactors 1, 2, and 3? The time period they're talking about is they're saying within 5 years, the spent fuel can be start to be removed and put into storage containers. As with anything with the nuclear industry, that is probably over-ambitious, and we're certainly looking at many, many years of this risk continuing.
So what are the implications for other countries, including the United States?
I get asked this question a lot. The most significant threat environmentally, in human health terms, for the marine environment, agriculture, everything, is in Japan. About 20% of the radioactive fallout from the atmospheric releases from the explosions and elsewhere landed on the mainland of Japan, which is why you have 8% of Japanese landmass contaminated up to hundreds and hundreds of kilometers away. But 80% of the atmospheric discharges went into the Pacific. Over into the Pacific, there was fallout into the Pacific. The Pacific is a large, enormous body of water, which means the radioactivity will disperse and will move through that environment. It will get absorbed by marine life, plankton in the first instance, but also seaweed. The greatest radiological threat, public health-wise, is in the coastal waters of Japan. However, as you will be aware, as listeners will be aware, that radioactivity doesn't know any boundaries and is moving through the Pacific, across the Pacific, and that levels have been detected, for example, on the west coast of continental America. My own feeling is, A, that radioactivity shouldn't be there. It's an indicator of how radioactivity knows no boundaries and spreads. I would be much more concerned about the radiological threats that exist from the U.S. nuclear program. For example, the liquid high-level waste tanks at Hanford in the northwest, the Diablo Canyon reactors that you mentioned, and the San Onofre reactors. The radiological threats from those sites are far more of a threat, I believe, than the Fukushima accident is to the people of North America. That doesn't mean it can be dismissed, but if people are most concerned and they want to get active on this, I would focus on the U.S. nuclear program because it has the largest stock of nuclear spent fuel on the planet, around 65,000 tons, scattered at over 50, 60 nuclear sites across the country.
So bringing up the topic of activists, there were many of us demonstrating last Sunday at San Onofre, and I know that there are activists who listen to this podcast regularly. Now that you are with Friends of Earth, what do you see it necessary for us to do, and how do you see Friends of Earth perhaps working with activists and supporting us in all of our local and national battles?
It's Friends of the Earth, and they were formed in California more than 40 years ago to fight nuclear power. So it's highly appropriate that we are joining up with local activists in Orange County, in San Diego, Los Angeles, to basically oppose California Edison and its ambitions to restart San Onofre. I think the opportunity to actually make California nuclear-free, not just for a few days, and it shouldn't be dependent upon plankton-type creatures at Diablo Canyon. You have regulators in this country that haven't done their job over decades, and that safety violations at nuclear power plants have been documented over the same decades. The opportunity now with San Onofre shut down is that we can keep those reactors shut down. We don't have to go through a relicensing process that would take 5, 6, 7, 8 or more years, and that California policymakers, politicians, need to understand that California doesn't need nuclear power, can be a much better society depending upon renewables and energy efficiency, and that the dominance of Pacific Gas and Electric, Southern California and Edison must end. the opportunities are there. And I would point particularly to the example of Germany, where I've been working last year. They see the future of the German economy is based upon renewables. German government and industry take their economic planning very seriously, and I've no doubt that they will achieve their ambition of being nuclear-free for an economy employing hundreds of thousands, if not many more, working on renewables. That has to be the future of California, and I think those working in the energy field, those informed about energy, those working on nuclear power, against nuclear power in California, absolutely can come together as they can across the United States.
Sean, this has been tremendously enlightening, and as you continue with your work for Friends of Earth, if you could keep us informed here at Nuclear Hot Seat, we'd love to pass on your information and do whatever we can to support you.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I've been speaking with Sean Burney, an independent nuclear consultant to Friends of the Earth, U.S., and to Greenpeace Germany. And we will keep following his actions and those of other activists around the world. Moving on to activist news, in Vernon, Vermont, the eight members of the Shut It Down Affinity Group, with three of their supporters, costumed themselves in hazmat suits and toted Geiger counter props as they appeared at the at Vermont Yankees nuclear power plant gate. They chained themselves to the gate and stretched crime scene tape across the driveway in their protest on April 24th. The Shut It Downers designed their presence in keeping with Earth Day, the previous Sunday, in order to call attention to Vermont Yankees' danger to the land, air, and water. According to Hattie Nessel, who's 73 years old, "We were able to breach security at the power plant by getting through the second gate. It was the first time we were able to lock the gate shut from the inside." The Vernon, Vermont police headquarters, where they were booked and released, did not set a court date for the women, who were aged 60 to 93. Tuesday's arrest marks the 18th time since 2005 that the Shut It Down Affinity Group has acted to close Vermont Yankee. Our friends at NEARS have let us know that 94 national, regional, and local organizations and small businesses have signed a letter urging the Senate Environment Committee to reject possible renomination of Christine Svinicki to a second term at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They released this letter and a press release supporting it on Monday, April 30th. In the letter, it was sent to Committee Chair Barbara Boxer, a Democrat of California, and Ranking Member James Imhoff, a Republican of Oklahoma. The 94 group said that, quote, "During her first term as an NRC commissioner, Ms. Svinicki uniformly voted for the nuclear industry interests at the expense of public health and safety." Michael Marriott, the Executive Director of Nuclear Information and Resource Service, NIRS, said about the letter, "Nuclear power is an inherently dangerous technology. We need NRC commissioners who understand that basic fact and will act accordingly. But Ms. Svinicki's record over the past 5 years indicates she will neither challenge the nuclear power industry nor support reforms that might improve nuclear safety. President Obama has indicated he intends to renominate Ms. Svinicki for a second term at the NRC over the opposition of lawmakers, including Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. However, this renomination has not yet taken place. Thus, the letter to the Senate was copied to President Obama as well." Final words from Michael Marriott: "Commissioner Svinicki has not earned a second term. The American people deserve better." And from Beyond Nuclear, they are outraged and asking us to share their outrage over a recent editorial in the Washington Post. On April 23rd, the Post editorial board proclaimed in a lead editorial that the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan was, quote, non-catastrophic. The writers eagerly promoted nuclear power while omitting inconvenient deal breakers such as cost, waste, safety, health risks, and human rights. According to the word coming out from Beyond Nuclear, they showed a shocking disregard for the suffering in Japan due to a very real catastrophe that is by no means over, and they utterly ignored those who have already paid the price for the nuclear fuel chain, like indigenous uranium miners and its newest victims, the children of Japan, whose futures have been stolen. Links to respond to the Washington Post editorial are on Nuclear Hot Seat and also can be found on Beyond Nuclear. In holistic healing, and this is something that I like to do on every program and talk about what we can do to protect ourselves from the effects of exposure to radiation or just exposure to the entire nuclear issue, and that's what I'm addressing this week. Whether we get toxed directly by radiation or we're just dealing with our fears and concerns as we work around the nuclear issue, there's plenty of stress to handle, and stress alone can create health problems. Bach flower remedies subtly address and rebalance our emotions through sublingual drops similar to homeopathics. These were created as a system of healing flower essences by Dr. Edward Bach. Each of the 38 flower remedies has a subtly different impact on our emotions. The best known, which you may have heard of, is Rescue Remedy, and it's a blend of 5 different flower essences. If you want to research the use of Bach flower remedies, speak with an holistic practitioner experienced in their usage, a homeopathic pharmacist, or you can go to the Bach Center website, which is BachCentre.com, and check out the various links and the pages that they have there. As a final thought, Southern California had a great rally outside the San Onofre nuclear reactors this past Sunday. In particular, Dan Hirsch of the Committee to Bridge the Gap spoke with impeccable clarity on the exact nature of the problems at San Onofre. If you haven't heard Dan speak before, I urge you to take a look at the video of his speech that I'll have up on Nuclear Hot Seat by this evening. In addition, Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com, who we interviewed on last week's Nuclear Hot Seat, was recently asked how to shut down nuclear reactors. He answered, "The way to shut a nuclear reactor down is to be a capitalist. The price of these things is so astronomical that Wall Street won't buy them. If we can stop the federal subsidies, you can stop the new nukes. The way to stop this process is to think like a capitalist." And he went on to say, Warren Buffett evaluated going into the new nuke business, and he said, "I can't figure out how to make money." Now, if Warren Buffett can't figure out how to make money, it's time to fold up the deck. So let's go out there and all of us think like capitalists and write a letter from that perspective and send it to our elected officials, the president, your state senators, your federal senators, your governor, and Senator Barbara Boxer, who chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Meanwhile, I will post a link to the full video interview with Arne on the Nuclear Hot Seat blog page. In closing, this has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, May 1st, 2012. You can find us syndicated to airprogressive.org, streaming web radio, posted on nuclearhotseat.com, on our 2 Facebook pages, Nuclear Hot Seat and Nuclear Hot Seat Group, and you can always subscribe on iTunes podcasts. This is Libby Halevy of Heartistry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep. Be safe, be well, and I'll speak with you again next week.